Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 353. Saturday, January 18th, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. So this is a conversation that I recorded yesterday? Yeah, yesterday, with Irv Mills. It's a conversation in three parts. I'm putting the first part last. Why would I do that? Because I put the first part up as a YouTube video yesterday. Some of you have heard that part of the conversation. Most of you have not. So for those who have, once you hear the normal end of the podcast, go ahead and tune out or turn off, skip to the next track, whatever you're going to do. But for those of you who do not follow my efforts on YouTube, well, after the regular close, you know, the fade out and back and forth channel switching of the guitar riff at the very end, after that, there's a whole nother half hour segment of conversation with Irv Mills on the topic of keeping pets. So before we get started, I want to share a beautiful, beautiful sentence with you. This comes from Investopedia.com. Many of the factors contributing to the CPI controversy are shrouded in complexities related to statistical methodology. I just love that sentence. Particularly the phrase, shrouded in complexities related to statistical methodology. If you have no opinions on statistical methodology, this sentence tells you that what follows will be of absolutely no interest to you and will probably make your head hurt. What's that all about? Well, the conversation with Irv will make that clear. Irv Mills has been on this podcast before. He is a blogger. His blog is called The Easiest Person to Fool. And Irv will be the first person to tell you that he has not followed me in my rejection of collapsitarian fixation. He describes himself unabashedly as a collapsnik, a term which, as far as I understand, was coined by Dmitry Orlov. All right, here is a conversation with Irv Mills.
So, okay, another of the articles that you suggested we might talk about, there was one. The title is Against Metrics, Measuring Performance by Numbers Backfires. And the reason I read that is before I retired, the last year and a bit that I worked with the local electric company, the provincial distribution and transmission company, I was a manager. And before that, I was the next step down, a supervisor of a crew of electricians. And I was sent on a lot of courses on how to do that job well, and got exposed to the idea of what a good idea it is to measure how you're doing your job. And, you know, if we can just get the right numbers, we can encourage you, incentivize you to do a better job of it. And watching how that worked in practice was, I guess I'd say, amusing. This is rampant throughout industry. Large companies, for the most part, or maybe even middle-sized ones. First of all, I think in a lot of cases, the way management works these days, the upper-level management people are first managers and secondarily, or maybe hardly at all, experts in the business that their company does.
Right. So top-level CEOs will go from one job to another where the two companies have completely different products.
You know, exactly.
It would seem that a completely different set of skills would be necessary, but no. I mean, at the top level, managerial level, it's all the same to them.
It's the same to them. As a guy who's been on the bottom level of management, I would say it's not the same, and it would be better if those guys had more experience in the industry that they're managing. And I think part of the reason they use the metrics is a way of getting around that. Rather than dealing with the people who work for them in such a way as it would encourage them to do a better job of their job, they'd have to know something about the job,
right,
in detail. Okay, well, let's just every month, I remember having to produce this little report and send it to my manager of some things he was interested in seeing how we were doing. Now, I was, interestingly, as a what they called a frontline manager, bottom level management, I was still in a union. And I actually retired during a fairly nasty strike of that union because I couldn't see myself going back and having to represent these people that I'd been striking against. But one thing that happened after the strike was those first level managers were no longer union members, and they had their own contract with the company, and that included a variety of incentives for their performance. So they'd gone right into this whole metrics thing. The thing about that is it reflects a kind of thinking, what I call, I think I invented this one, so it's probably not very inspired, but these guys, the managers who are insisting on these metrics, are what I call one-step willies. They come up with an idea, we'll do this, and then this good thing will happen. And they don't seem to be able to get the idea that, yes, you'll do this, and the people you're doing this to will respond in a variety of ways, which, for the most part, won't be what you intended to happen at all. If they're well socialized, what they'll do is look like they're doing it, but behind your back, they'll be gaming the whole idea, so that while the numbers look good, the actual results are not. Or you guys like me, and I just didn't give a darn. I took care of the people working for me in the way that I thought was the right way, tried to accomplish the work we had to do as it should be done. And if that didn't lead to my monthly numbers being good, well, I didn't really care. And probably only stayed in the job for about a year because I could see I wasn't cut out to do that kind of a job, you know. Didn't have the loyalty to the people above me that I needed. But anyways, the article basically says what I've been saying, and that the kind of troubles that a lot of big corporations get into results from relying on these metrics rather than actually knowing what's going on and mentoring the people below you in the management ladder in such a way that they can do their job better. And of course, the other thing that happens when people start gaming the situation, one response management has is they start making rules to deal with each of the individual instances of gaming. Yep. And of course, people can game the rules as well, but that makes things more complex than they need to be in the company. And in a lot of cases, that reduces productivity something fierce if everybody's working around a whole bunch of rules to get their jobs done. So anyway, that's why I read that article. I thought I thought the guy who had written it was right on the mark with what he had to say about this.
I will admit that I forgot about that topic until just now, so I never got to read that article. But I'm very familiar with the phenomenon. And in fact, I encountered a formulation of it quite recently, and I don't remember the source now, but it went something like this. When you use a numerical measurement as a goal, it ceases to be a measurement. Because people will try to game the system, you know, to reach the goal. And so that number, which once actually showed you what was actually happening, it doesn't anymore. Because, you know, people are focused on the number, and they are skimping on the activity that the number is supposed to measure.
Yeah, they're spending their time making sure the number comes out right instead of the other thing that's in the article they mentioned, and this really struck a chord with me, is it takes a fair amount of time and effort to gather the data for these metrics and produce the reports that present it to people. Time that might well be spent better doing a person's job. Instead
a lot of that measurement is now being automated.
Yeah, we were getting into that sort of thing too. And I imagine 15 years later, it'll be a lot more so, but yeah.
For those who haven't read it, there's an article, I think it was in Harper's a few years back, like probably around 2015, by Esther Kaplan. It was called The Spy Who Fired Me. And she's talking all about workplace surveillance and the new mobile sensors, which are allowing, like, she was focused on UPS drivers and how their truck and their body, the position and the speed at which they're moving is being monitored second by second. And it's just, you know, running them ragged, basically. And they are trying to find all kinds of ways to cheat the system to make those numbers look right, you know, on those daily reports. But it gets harder and harder. And part of this same phenomenon is like companies like Kronos. They're basically using fine control of, you know, monitoring of workers and then manipulating their status as to whether they're on or off the clock, such that you're not actually on the clock unless you are in the process of performing a movement for which you get paid. And as soon as you stop moving, even for a second, you're off the clock. So you might,
oh my God.
Yeah, you might work a 10-hour shift someplace, but only get paid for 7 hours. Or, you know, you might work right through your break because of the demands of the environment, but, you know, you don't get paid for the time that you were supposed to be on break, even if you worked through it. And there's all these, you know, companies, and Kronos is the big one, but their whole purpose, I mean, they won't say this in their advertising, but the whole aim of their endeavor is to help employers claw back wages from employees, you know, with
I'd say that clearly what that is.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that these companies aren't unionized as well.
Irv, I am 51 years old. I cannot tell you how many jobs I've held in my life, you know, easily in the double digits, possibly, probably not triple, but high double digits. I've never had the opportunity to participate in a union. It's not that I've, you know, declined to join a union. I've never been in a workplace where unions were present.
That's the way it's gone, yeah. For sure. I started in the spring of 1974, and I worked until the end of June 2005, and I was in a union the whole time. And it was a closed shop.
One employer?
Yeah, one employer. Okay, yeah, see, I'm a boomer. That doesn't happen to people anymore. I know, I realize
like a medieval guild. They're in the same category for me. It's a way that, you know, labor used to be organized, mm-hmm. and just isn't anymore. Those few holdouts.
Yeah,
who largely are in public sector jobs here in the U.S.
Yeah, I don't know. I could go on at some length about the advantages to unions, but
they're great, but you know, that whole organizational push has been solidly defeated.
It has, yes, and what a pity. That sort of leads into the next subject we were going to discuss. There was an article here, the title was "Welcome to the Global Rebellion Against Neoliberalism," and certainly the defeat of the union movement is, I would say, part of what's been going on in neoliberalism for the last few decades. So
how would you define neoliberalism without, you know, reading a quote from the article or something?
Well,
just off the top of your head, what is it? Before you read anything, what does it mean?
Okay, what does it mean to me?
Yeah.
Well, it's okay. I got to put it in terms of class consciousness, mm-hmm. which is something I think is drastically lacking, certainly in North America at the moment. But it's simply there's an upper class, call them the capitalists or the whatever you want to call them, but they run the outfit, the whole world. And neoliberalism would consist of a whole bunch of laws and regulations and governments set up to make sure those guys do well and to make sure they're really good at exploiting the labor of the rest of us to the extent of, in many cases, eliminating the labor of the rest of us if it helps them make profit. It's all about companies doing well and working class people suffering.
So now go ahead and supplement that with what you wanted to read.
Okay, I think it was a meme on Facebook. I printed it out and it didn't come out with any URL or anything. And it says this, it's got two columns here. And one is what you think it means, what it actually means. Neoliberal, a new type of phony pro-corporate Democrat who's not really that liberal. And what it actually means, an advocate for a political project of capital aiming to redistribute wealth upward via privatization, austerity, etc. And this has been the bipartisan Washington consensus since Reagan.
And so I think that's an important distinction, because the word neoliberal has the word liberal in it. If you're not familiar with the history of the word or how it's used, it might be tempting to think that, yeah, this is a particular sin of the Democratic Party. But neoliberalism is a bipartisan consensus, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. There is an ownership class. There are working people. There is a thin strata of professional managerial people who side with the ownership class because it's in their interest to do so. And that there is a global pushback against neoliberalism, which there are left-wing expressions of it and right-wing expressions of it. And I'm not sure about the particular article from, what was it, The Nation?
Yes, it was from The Nation.
I did read it, but it's kind of lost now in my, the storehouse of general knowledge. But I had sent a couple links to Mark Blythe talks to you, because Mark Blythe really talks about this very subject, about, he's got a talk called The Global Trumpian Revolution. He's no Trump fan, but he's saying, look, if you think that the only reason anybody would vote for Trump is because they're a racist, you're completely ignoring the class interest of, like, two-thirds of the planet. People are finding different expressions and reasons, or articulations anyway, for their reasons to push back against this global neoliberal order. And the temptation is to only have sympathy for those who, if you're a left-winger, who express it in a left-wing way, and to say nasty things about people who express that exact same motivation from a right-wing perspective or from a nationalist perspective.
It does lead to that, I did watch the shorter of the two.
I have to admit, I didn't watch it before I sent it to you. I just looked for something short.
It was good. Oh, it was good, and it certainly addresses this. And I watched part of the longer one, which, interestingly, wasn't a lengthier repeat of the shorter one. He was talking about, sort of think of capitalism as the software we use to run our economies, our world, if you will. And he was talking about how it had changed during the 20th century and moving on into this century. And a little tangent, if you'll forgive me, I'm going to go off on.
It's a podcast. We're all about tangents here.
Yeah. And I want to hear what you think of this. Just the other day, a friend of mine, who's also my financial advisor, emailed me a link to a clip on YouTube where a guy, supposedly a financial expert, was saying, the government's been, and this ties back to what we're talking about, metrics. The government's been messing with the consumer price index, which is a major metric that we judge inflation on, I guess, mainly. They messed with the calculation of the consumer price index twice, apparently, once around 1980 and once around 1990. So the results show less inflation than they would have before. And for anything that's, if you've got a cost of living contract in your contract, which we did, and I still do, even in retirement, have that. So that's a soft touch. But the thing is, since the CPI is a smaller number than in some sense it should be, anything that's tied to that is less effective. And that stuck with me because Mark Blythe was talking about how at one point in the global financial crisis in 2008, we kind of changed how we're running our economies, in that we went to the central banks and said, help, save us from this mess. And they did, by lowering interest rates and printing money. But if you look at the typical figures that governments everywhere seem to produce, you'll see that the economy's been ticking along about 2% growth, just the way the economists say it should be since then. However, if we calculated the inflation the way we did 30, 40 years ago, you would find that, in fact, the inflation-corrected figures for that growth would be bad. And as a working class person on a pension, a fixed income, I have good reason to believe that that's true. Everything costs more than it did 15 years ago when I retired. And even with, I think I get 3/4 what the working guys get in the way of cost of living increases. And I don't think because of the diddled consumer price index, we've ever got much in the way of a cost of living increase, where if we were using the original way of calculating a CPI, we'd probably have had several of them. So when I was listening to Mark in his video talking about, I don't think it was the heart of his argument, but he was observing that there'd been, moderate growth and little in the way of inflation. I'm thinking, well, depends who you believe on that one. And certainly in terms of the rebellion against neoliberalism, part of it is that there has been inflation. What it costs to live for ordinary people has gone up in the last decade or two a lot. And people are to the point where they can't just grin and bear it anymore, where it's causing civil unrest in a lot of different places around the world.
So I'm going to interrupt the conversation with Irv here and share with you some more of that lovely, lovely article that I found on Investopedia, Why the Consumer Price Index is Controversial. As I often do in my videos, I'm going to read a bit at the beginning of the article and then switch to just summarizing. And selective summarizing at that. The article is called Why the Consumer Price Index is Controversial by Barclay Palmer. This is from June 25th, 2019. And because this is talking about economics, it is heavy on acronyms. I'm going to read out all the acronyms, except for Consumer Price Index, which is CPI. This one appears so often in what I'm about to read, I don't want to read it out the full phrase Consumer Price Index every time. So I won't bother you with BLS, or COGI, or COLI, but I will rely on you to remember that CPI is Consumer Price Index. The Bureau of Labor Statistics produces the Consumer Price Index, or CPI. It is the most widely watched and used measure of the U.S. inflation rate. It is also used to determine the real gross domestic product. From an investor's perspective, the CPI, as a proxy for inflation, is a critical measure that can be used to estimate the total return on a nominal basis required for an investor to meet his or her financial goals. For several years, there has been a controversy about whether the CPI overstates or understates inflation, how it is measured, and whether it is an appropriate proxy for inflation. One of the primary reasons for this contention is that economists differ on how they feel inflation should be measured. The controversy. Originally, the CPI was determined by comparing the price of a fixed basket of goods and services spanning two different periods. In this case, the CPI was a cost of goods index, or COGI. However, over time, the U.S. Congress embraced the view that the CPI should reflect changes in the cost to maintain a constant standard of living. Consequently, the CPI has evolved into a cost of living index, or COLI. I'm going to pause there and just summarize a little bit of what I just read. Basically, the Consumer Price Index originally was just a collection of things that people generally needed to buy to live in this country. Over time, though, people bought different things. Do any of you still have milk delivered to your door each day by a milkman? I don't know that milk delivery was ever in the CPI, but if it ever was, it shouldn't be anymore because that doesn't really happen anymore. Certainly not widely enough for it to be a measure of how, you know, Americans or Canadians or Mexicans live. What about the price of computers? Should the price of computers be included in the consumer price index? How about the price of smartphones? How about the price of Bluetooth speakers? If these things were included, and, you know, if the performance, the power of these devices was also calculated so that you were not just, you know, looking at the price for a computer, but the price for how much computing power you could buy for a dollar, what would that do to the consumer price index? So, continuing from the Investopedia article. Over the years, the methodology used to calculate the CPI has undergone numerous revisions. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the changes removed biases that caused the CPI to overstate the inflation rate. The new methodology takes into account changes in the quality of goods and substitution. Substitution, the change in purchases by consumers in response to price changes, changes the relative weighting of the goods in the basket. The overall result tends to be a lower CPI. However, critics view the methodological changes and the switch from a cost of goods index to a cost of living index as a purposeful manipulation that allows the U.S. government to report a lower CPI. So what did that just say? Well, it says that while it makes sense to make changes to the CPI based on the changes in people's purchasing habits and basically people's living patterns, if these changes aren't conducted, you know, with just absolutely scrupulous intention, like neutral intention. If the goal is to change the way the CPI is calculated to make it look as if inflation is low, well, that can be done, and it is argued that it has been done. On the other hand, if you treat the CPI as a cost of living index and you don't make changes in it to account for the changes in people's lifestyles, then the CPI is going to overstate inflation. Continuing. John Williams, a U.S. economist and analyst of government reporting, prefers a CPI or inflation measure calculated using the original methodology based on a basket of goods having quantities and qualities fixed. David Ronson, another U.S. economist, also questions the official CPI's viability as an indicator of inflation. Unlike Williams, Ronson does not espouse the viewpoint that the CPI is manipulated. Instead, Ronson's view is that the CPI is a lagging indicator of inflation and is not a good indicator of current inflation. According to Ronson, increases in the price of commodities are a better indicator of current inflation because inflation initially affects commodity prices, and it may take several years for this commodity inflation to work its way through an economy and be reflected in the CPI. Ronson bases his inflation measure on a commodity basket of precious metals. What is immediately apparent is there are three different definitions of the consumer price index. Since these definitions are not operationally equivalent, each method of measuring inflation leads to different results. Different CPI or inflation levels. The different methods of measuring inflation produce disparate indications of inflation for the same period. For example, the November 2006 Consumer Price Index summary, which is published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, stated that during the first 11 months of 2006, the CPIU, which stands for Consumer Price Index for All Urban Consumers, that's CPI-U, the CPIU rose at a 2.2% seasonally adjusted annual rate, or SAAR. Williams' estimate of the CPI for the same period was 5.3%, while Ronson's reported an 8.2% estimate. So here we've got three different economists with three different opinions on how inflation should be measured, and depending on which of the three you look at, in 2006, the inflation rate was either 2.2%, 5.3%, or 8.2%. The difference between 2.2 and 8.2 when talking about inflation is enormous. Continuing, the differences between the Bureau of Labor Statistics Consumer Price Index, or BLS CPI, and the figures attained by Williams and Ronson would be of sufficient magnitude whereby if the CPI is manipulated downward, the outcome of an investment plan could be less than effective. Therefore, a prudent investor may wish to obtain more insight and a better understanding of these disparate views of CPI and inflation measures and the effects they may have on their investment decisions. So this is where I'm going to stop reading and begin selectively summarizing because, as this is an article on Investopedia, it answers to the interests of investors and not the interests of people who are talking about, you know, how easy it is for normal working people, which is to say people who don't have any equity in the stock market, how they live and get by in the world in these rapidly changing economic times. So again, the title of this piece that I'm reading from and summarizing is Why the Consumer Price Index is Controversial. So the next section is Implications for the GDP, or Gross Domestic Product. And, you know, GDP is often used as the single numerical indicator of the health of the U.S. economy, or any country's economy. From the article, the GDP is one of many economic indicators investors can use to gauge the growth rate and strength of an economy. The CPI plays a vital role in the determination of the real gross domestic product. Therefore, manipulation of the CPI could imply manipulation of the GDP because the CPI is used to deflate some of the nominal GDP components for the effects of inflation. CPI and GDP have an inverse relationship, so a lower CPI and its inverse effect on GDP could suggest to investors that the economy is stronger than it really is. And the plot thickens. CPI and government spending. Governments also use CPI to set future expenditures. Many government expenses are based on the CPI, and therefore any lowering of the CPI would have a significant effect on future government expenditures. A lower CPI provides at least two major benefits to the government. One, many government payments, such as Social Security and the returns from TIPS, and TIPS there is an acronym standing for Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, which is a bond, which is indexed to inflation so that, you know, people who are buying government bonds don't get screwed if there's a period of rapidly rising prices, you know, consumer prices. So again, one, many government payments, such as Social Security and the returns from Treasury inflation-protected securities, are linked to the level of the CPI. Therefore, a lower CPI translates into lower payments and lower government expenditures. And two, the CPI deflates some components used to calculate the real GDP. A lower inflation rate is reflective of a healthier economy. In other words, if the true rate of inflation is higher than the CPI, as the government calculates it, then an investor's real rate of return will be less than originally expected as the unplanned amount of inflation eats away at gains. And I know if investing and economics is not your thing, this is getting stale fast, So I'll be selective in what I share from this going forward, and I'll bring it to a conclusion as quickly as I can. But there are additional factors adding to the controversy. Many of the factors contributing to the CPI controversy are shrouded in complexities related to statistical methodology. Oh, I just love that sentence. Other major contributors to the controversy hinge on the definition of inflation and the fact that inflation must be measured by proxy. The Bureau of Labor Statistics describes the CPI as a measure of the average change in the price of goods and services over time purchased by households on an average day-to-day basis. The Bureau of Labor Statistics uses a cost-of-living framework to guide its decisions regarding the statistical procedures used to determine the CPI. This framework means that the inflation rate indicated by the CPI reflects the changes in the cost of living or the cost of maintaining a fixed standard of living or quality of life. In other words, it is a cost of living index. CPI and consumer behavior. To illustrate a simplified example of the effect of the CPI on consumer behavior and its different calculation methodologies, assume the following scenario where the substitution happens at the item level, within a category in keeping with the Bureau of Labor Statistics methodology. Suppose that the only consumer good is beef. There are only two different cuts available, filet mignon and T-bone steak. In the prior period, when prices and consumption were last measured, only filet mignon was purchased, and the price of T-bone steak was 10% less than the price of filet mignon. When next measured, prices had increased by 10%, so the price per pound before the price increase of filet mignon was $12. After the price increase, it was $13.20. That's a price increase of 10%. Before the price increase, the T-bone steak cost $10, and after the price increase, it was $11. Again, a price increase of 10%. So in this scenario, if after these price changes, consumers still continue to buy filet mignon instead of T-bone steak, then the rate of inflation is 10%. But according to how the government calculates the consumer price index, if in response to these price increases, Instead of continuing to buy filet mignon at the increased price, consumers switch over to the T-bone steak. So as before, they were paying $12 for filet mignon, and now they're paying $11 for a T-bone steak. Well, prices have increased, but because of the changes in consumer behavior, which is to say the substitution of a cheaper product for the product they used to buy, the CPI will indicate 0% inflation. Okay, I'm not going to delve into this anymore, as the complexities related to statistical methodology are starting to make my brain hurt. But if I could summarize all of that, I would say the consumer price index is controversial because people who are investing for retirement, they need to know how much money is going to be coming in on a monthly basis to meet their needs or to allow them to maintain their, you know, their accustomed lifestyle or quality of life. They need to know the actual rate of inflation. But there's no way to measure the actual rate of inflation, which is completely objective. You have to make some decisions about what proxy indicators you're going to use to determine what that rate of inflation is. The government, on the other hand, wants the rate of inflation as reflected by the consumer price index to be low, because in turn, a low CPI increases the GDP, and the GDP is the big number. That's the number everybody pays attention to determine how well the economy is doing. If GDP is high, or if it has increased under a particular administration or, you know, congressional electoral period, then, you know, people in office can brag about that. Also, if the CPI indicates that prices are increasing for consumers, then any government payments which are linked to the cost of living have to go up, which costs the government more money, which puts a strain on budgets. So investors and just normal people, you know, to the extent that they think about things like the consumer price index, need the CPI to accurately reflect inflation or to overestimate it. Overestimating it is in their benefit. And the government has, you know, an opposite set of incentives. And it is even more complicated than that. I mean, that is a super simplified look at the consumer price index. But again, let's go back to computers. When the iPhone first came out, it was a $600 phone, which at the time was absurd. At the time, business people loved the BlackBerry. And BlackBerry, you know, their executives laughed at the iPhone. They said, $600 for a phone? Nobody's going to pay that. Who do you know who uses a BlackBerry now? Now, I have a phone by Huawei, the Mate SE. I got it about 13 months ago. I paid $220 for it. It is way better than the original iPhone. I mean, it is Superman to the original iPhone's Green Arrow. Superman can fly, survive in space, shoot laser beams from his eyes. He's virtually indestructible. And Green Arrow is really good with a bow and arrow. He's the DC Comics equivalent of Hawkeye. How should the price of my Huawei Mate SE affect calculations on the cost of living, the stability of consumer good prices, or the increase or decrease of those prices? I mean, I have that $220 phone, but if you want a new iPhone, it costs over $1,000 now. Again, though, it's way, way better than the original iPhone, which was introduced in 2006. How much of your life is spent fiddling with your phone? How many hours a day do you have it in your hand, or are listening to podcasts through it, or music, or checking your email? In 2006, yeah, people had phones, people had BlackBerries, people were addicted to their devices, but nothing like they are now. But if the CPI is supposed to be a measure of quality of life, how deep do you dig into that concept? I mean, you could well argue that these super powerful phones, which are tracking us and allowing corporations to amass huge dossiers about our movements, our associations, our patterns of consumption, and then to make predictions about our behavior and figure out who is interested in those predictions and sell them information about, you know, accurate information about how we are likely to behave in the near future. One could well argue that many of the effects of carrying around these supercomputers in our pockets, that many of these effects are detrimental to our quality of life. But surely that's an opinion, right? That's not something that you could bake into an official government statistic like the Consumer Price Index. Or is it? Again, there is no objective way to measure inflation. You have to pick proxies, and whatever proxies you pick are going to reflect certain biases. So one bias might say, look, if somebody is using their phone you know, 10 times as much as they did a decade ago, that probably indicates that the phone is 10 times more useful to them, and it represents a great benefit, a great increase in their quality of life. And another person might say, no, the fact that they're using it 10 times more indicates that the apps on that phone are designed to be addictive. And quality of life, particularly as measured by the amount of face-to-face contact that people enjoy, has markedly and measurably diminished in the last decade. Which point of view do you bake into the official government statistic? So I'm bringing this to a close now. This aside, the whole point though is this: you've probably heard before that the government manipulates the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, to make the current administration look good. And there's certainly an element of truth to that. But what I hoped that I've communicated over the last 10 minutes or whatever it is that while there is some element of truth to that story, it is an enormous, enormous oversimplification. That really figuring out how to measure inflation and figuring out how to measure quality of life or standard of living is difficult. And people have different opinions about how to go about doing it, which means it's controversial. Okay, back to the conversation with Irv Mills. I had to look it up to make sure I've got the title right. Mark Blyth's 2015 book is called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. So Mark Blyth is solidly against austerity policies. And in more detail, you know, there is a practice where private equity firms will go and buy municipal debt or sovereign debt from a poor country, and then and demand as part of the terms of servicing the debt that public utilities be privatized and the rates that consumers pay be jacked up dramatically in order to satisfy, you know, the requirements of debt service. Yeah. And so basically, you know, hedge funders and Wall Street types are directly responsible for, you know, fuel prices or the elimination of subsidies on food in poor countries, or, you know, rapid increases in, you know, public transportation costs, things like this, things which often lead to uprisings. And there is a fine tuned science of squeezing just a little bit less hard than, you know, would produce an uprising. And if there is an uprising and it looks bad, they'll relent a little bit for a little while and then go back to squeezing. And, you know, Mark Blyth's whole presentation is in opposition to these practices. And, you know, to the very idea that imposing austerity on people at the bottom of the social hierarchy is going to lead to long-term growth. He says it absolutely will not.
Good for him.
Yeah. That's his larger project. So you may have found a place in there where he said something that you thought, you know, you'd read something that didn't agree with that, and maybe that, you know, that derails his whole project. I'm telling you, if you know what Mark Blyth is about, you do not want to derail his whole project.
No, and it sounds like, indeed, he's talking about the same thing I'm talking about as far as that goes.
Before we continue, I want to put something on the table, which I imagine you know, but I want the listeners to be particularly cognizant of it. In the United States, at least, food and fuel prices are not counted. They're not considered when calculating the inflation rate. But fuel prices dramatically, you know, they fluctuate dramatically, or they can. Yeah. You know, we've certainly lived through periods where they have. And as fuel prices increase, food prices follow, you know, because that food has to be delivered. And fossil fuels are necessary for pretty much every step in the industrial agricultural process. So if you eliminate fluctuating energy and food prices from the inflation rate, or your, you know, the way you calculate inflation, inflation looks not only tame, but it also looks fairly predictable and fairly stable and something that can easily be managed. And it is easily managed from the perspective of people at the top, because changes in the price of food and fuel don't affect their lifestyle. But for working people and struggling people, you know, behind rent, food and fuel are probably their major expenses.
Yes. And interesting you should bring up rent, because you may have noticed the price of housing going up in...
I haven't, but I have a lucky situation. I have very stable...
And, well, I suppose if you're beyond commuting distance from a large city, then probably housing prices aren't going up. But anywhere where people can drive to their work from, the price of housing has gone up. And a large part of that, of course, is that the upper classes are looking for something good to invest in, and real estate's such a thing. And they can control, just as you were saying, they can work around to controlling the price of fuel and various utility type things. Well, they can control, certainly directly as landlords, control the price of rents if they aren't controlled, and the same thing with forcing up the price of houses as well. And those three things, fuel, food, and housing, are approaching being beyond the reach of a great many people.
Well, particularly young people who are, you know, much to the chagrin of their elders, not getting married, not buying houses, not taking on a lot of what are considered to be, you know, the defining aspects of adult life.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're 27 and there's just no way that you could possibly afford your own house, but you can live with two or three other guys in their 20s and share expenses, likely not going to be having kids, or you're likely not going to be getting married. And it's quite likely that, you know, as you leave your 20s and enter your 30s, you're still spending most of your non-work time at home playing video games and smoking pot and, you know, not looking much like an adult. And it's not a moral failing on the part of young people these days. It is the circumstances in which they live and how they have adapted to those circumstances.
Absolutely. My youngest child actually turned 34 yesterday, and he is married, but never intending to have kids. And they're just in the process of trying to find a house, but it's going to be not the traditional man and wife and house. It's going to be probably two couples sharing a house in order to get enough income that they can afford it, that they can afford the mortgage that they will have it. They're living in a town called Guelph, which is northwest of Toronto, certainly less than an hour's drive. So there's a lot of people living in Guelph and commuting to Toronto. You can actually get a bus or a train from there, so it makes it easier. And that has put the price of housing in Guelph up to, you know, outrageous. What looked to me like outrageous levels. $500,000 for a house seems to me like rather a lot. But that's,
yeah,
that's what they're looking at. You know,
in New York City, that's a cheap apartment.
Yeah, I know. And it's not much about it. You might be able to get a broom closet for that price in Toronto as well. So there you go. Anyways, that almost, I guess, there's probably lots more to be said about neoliberalism. And I'm reassured to hear that guys like Mark Blythe are against, certainly, austerity. Sounds to me like he's probably against the whole project of neoliberalism. But I don't know. How can it be almost all the economies that we're talking about here are what I think you could call consumer economies? And consumers are working class people. And if you squeeze them so hard, they're almost on the point of rebellion. How can they be good consumers? They don't have any discretionary income left. So,
well, because of automation and AI and whatnot, the price of production is plummeting. So you can still, as long as you can make your products cheaper, you can still sell them to people at a profit.
Yeah. Although you could see...
There is a bottom to that, of course.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. You extrapolate that out a little bit and either, well, obviously at some point you'll... run up against the limit of current technology, And at some point, you'll run up the limit against of the austerity measures we were talking about, where even where working class people can't avoid cheap plastic stuff from China anymore. And that hurts China and everybody else, I guess is the point. Also, so that somebody who's already rich can become a little bit richer. I find it hard not to be a little upset by that. I don't know. What do you think? Is it okay for rich people to keep getting richer? is all the money in the world enough? I suspect not.
Here's where my interest corresponds with your concerns there. David Graeber wrote a very well-received book called Debt, The First 5,000 Years.
And I've read it.
Yeah. You know, if you read just the first quarter of it, you get the takeaway message, which is this. Rich people for thousands of years have used the language of morality to convince poor people that their lives aren't worth anything unless they are toiling in the service of rich people.
Yeah.
And my father was the paradigm example of that. I mean, he's Irish American from New York City, wanted to be a cop his whole life, spent his, you know, the majority of his career in the U.S. Secret Service, respected authority to a fault. And he was just the poster boy for this mentality that, you know, as a working person, your dignity, your self-worth, your worth, you know, your worthiness as a human being is all dependent on your entering into a, you know, a relationship with an employer where you have no power and, you know, your worth is determined by how much of yourself you give to the project of making somebody else rich. He never would have expressed it like that, but, you know, that's what he thought. I mean, he's the man who told me when I, you know, as we were wrestling over college, because I wanted to go to art school and he didn't want me to go to art school. He said, get a degree, not an education.
Yes.
To say, get the credentials which demonstrate to an employer that you are pliable and willing to do what is asked of you, and you will go far.
Yeah.
And which, you know, is antithetical to my whole person and being.
All right. Well, I was that sort of a father up to a point. And then I sort of realized that this doesn't seem to be working.
Well, like my father didn't live long enough. He didn't make it to the 21st century, so he didn't get to see, you know, the last 20 years.
Near the end of Graeber's book, he comments that following the Second World War, there was a period where, and actually Mark Blythe talks about this, that's the period he defines from about 1945 to 1980, where there was sort of a peace was struck between the workers, unionized workers, and the corporations, where they said, the workers basically said, we'll keep productivity high, you pay us well, and everybody will be happy. Yeah, it was.
And the motivation for maintaining that relationship went away with the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
When the world was no longer defined by the competition between the capitalist ethos and the communist ethos, there was no reason whatsoever to placate the workers anymore.
Yeah.
When communism was no longer even an imaginary option, there's no point. As Margaret Thatcher says, there is no alternative. You know, you don't have the option of going and you know, joining the communist utopia. You are stuck here in the real capitalist world, and you will behave as you are expected to.
Everywhere in the world, there is only one political party, the neoliberals. And you can't get away from them.
Well, I'm not going to sign off on you can't get away with it or get away from it. Not immediately anyway, but I think politically. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm... Every single day, honestly, every single day, I tune in to a political show called Rising. It is from The Hill, which I think is a fairly conservative newspaper or magazine. I never interact with the print version of it, but they have a couple of shows which are only available on YouTube. And it's pretty intently focused on, right now, the Democratic primary contest. And both of the commentators in this show, Crystal Ball and oh, what's his name? Sagar and Jetty, I think his name is. She is far left. He is, you know, kind of libertarian right, but they're both in total agreement on their criticisms of the Democratic Party because it is utterly in the service of neoliberalism. And I've never had this before in my life. There's a show that I can tune into every single day where both commentators are saying things which I agree with 100%. That has never, ever been the case. I mean, there have been podcasts that I could tune into where I pretty much agreed with everything the podcaster had to say. But this is a TV show in a professional studio, you know, with professional production values. And there's these two people saying things that I agree with, which is just completely alien to the rest of my life's experience. It's never.
Yeah, and I'm so interested. This is called Rising?
Rising, yes.
Okay, I can no doubt find that. I'll have to watch that. Yes, there may be hope down the road. You know?
But something that, you know, the two hosts of Rising point out every day is how just utterly antagonistic every corporate news media outlet is to Bernie Sanders. They demonize him at every turn. And because they know which side of the bread the butter is on, you know, and it's not,
well,
it's not on the Bernie Sanders side.
You know, coming from a different country where the Overton window is slid to the left from the one you have in the States.
You want to define that right quick? Overton window. Wait, I think most window. People know what it is, but for those who don't.
Yeah, it's okay. Take the political spectrum of left to right. What you see in the media from which you, you know, which it's like water to fish, is not the whole spectrum. It's a window on that spectrum. And in fact, it isn't necessarily centered on the center of the spectrum. It'll be, it could be to the right, it could be to the left. In fact, if I can say this about the United States, it's well over to the right.
Has been. It's shifting rapidly to the left now, but yes.
I see that. But a guy like Bernie is certainly not a leftist. You know, you could say social democrat. I know people here in my own family who would say, yeah, Bernie, that's great. But really, he's hardly the left of center.
In the U.S., picture. He's pretty far to the left.
Yeah, I know. Because the Overton window is cranked over to the right. And to be honest, the Overton window in Canada is a little bit to the left of that, but not a whole long way. Nobody here is suggesting that the means of production should be owned by the government. You know, we're not into communism. We're just social democrats, you know, compared to outright capitalists like you have in the States. And certainly all three of our political parties are clearly neoliberal. There's no question.
Of course.
So what the big companies want is what we have to do, you know, growth and jobs. That's what we got to produce.
On the topic of the Overton window, I just want to point out that 4 years ago, in 2016, Bernie Sanders was saying Medicare for all, and Hillary Clinton, who is the standard bearer for neoliberal mainstream, you know, Democratic politics, was unthinkable. And now all of the Democratic candidates, even the ones who don't believe in Medicare for all, say that they're for it, and then they try to, you know, quibble at the margins about how they would do things a little bit differently than Bernie would. But the Overton window has shifted dramatically in the last 4 years. So that, you know,
sure
right now, like 4 years ago, this on the Democratic side, the conventional wisdom was, yeah, we have a lot of uninsured people, and yeah, medicine's really expensive, and it's really, you know, destroying a lot of people's finances, and that's really a shame, but we're not going to do anything about it. To now, the question is, what are you going to do about it, and how quickly are you going to move? And then, you know, Bernie's certainly shifted the Overton window dramatically over the last 4 years. And then in the last year, Andrew Yang has really shifted it. You know, the idea that we would just pay people for being citizens, that's, you know, utter communist craziness by the standard conventional Overton window of the late 20th century. And now I think that's going to be the new Medicare for all. I think over the next 4 years, the idea of a freedom dividend is going to grow legs and become, you know, it's going to move from being a kooky, unthinkable idea to, I don't know if we're ready quite just yet to do that, but yeah, it's probably inevitable.
Yeah. Maybe so.
The Overton window is much bigger and moves a lot faster than it used to.
Yeah, well, and that's a good thing. A good thing indeed. It's incomprehensible, you know, to people other than in the United States that you wouldn't have some sort of socialized medicine, healthcare.
Well,
they
don't have anything like that in China. You know, China, they call themselves communists, but they don't provide any medical care.
Yeah.
They don't provide any, you know, retirement benefits. They have almost no social safety net at all. The Chinese answer to the question of what are you going to do about a social safety net is to subsidize all manner of unprofitable businesses so long as they create employment.
Yeah, so everybody's got a job.
You know, to take care of all their needs based on their income.
Yeah.
Which is really sort of libertarian, you know, laissez-faire, sink or swim sort of system.
Kind of ironic, considered it's in a communist country. Yeah, yeah, not really. That's pretty strange, indeed. Yeah.
I mean, the U.S. is communist by comparison because at least we give, you know, medical care to old people.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And, okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think we may have, we may be getting close to the end of this. How's the time, Camel?
It is 3:54. We started a little after 2:30. So yeah, we've got material that's going to spill out of the podcast and onto YouTube, I think. I'll put the dog part on YouTube and maybe on the main Sea Realm podcast.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's been great talking to you.
As always.
Yeah, you bet.
Before you go, I just want to say, Irv and I are talking because he posted a link to a blog post of his on the Sea Realm discussion group on MeWe.com, which I will admit I don't look at every day, and I don't post to even every week. But what little conversation takes place there is pretty high quality stuff. So I would encourage more Sea Realm Vault listeners to check into the Sea Realm MeWe group from time to time and, you know, post something there. It doesn't have to be an article. It doesn't have to be anything particularly deep, just as long as it touches on some topic that is obviously of shared concern to people who listen to the Sea Realm Vault podcast. Your contribution is more than welcome and would be greatly appreciated. All right, Irv, thank you so much. Talk to you again
soon. You're welcome, sir. You bet.
Okay, this is a long podcast, but I know most of you don't mind long podcasts. Before I go, I'm going to read a piece of feedback. This feedback from Jasper comes, I think, mostly in response to video content that I have produced regularly. For those of you who have been following my YouTube efforts, this feedback will be very congruent with everything you've heard from me in recent weeks and months. For those of you who only follow my podcast output, I don't think I could encapsulate everything that this letter is responding to, or this email is responding to. But in the briefest of brief outlines, over the past year, I've taken in a couple of books and a great many talks and interviews by an author named Peter Zeihan, who used to be, years ago, the protege of, what's his name, George Friedman. Friedman, who in the 90s, I think, made a big splash by predicting a coming war between the United States and Japan. I think what he failed to see was the impending economic stagnation in Japan, which put a halt to their growth and, you know, to the growth of their power, which would have put them on a collision course with the U.S. But Peter Zeihan, in his books, The Accidental Superpower and The Absent Superpower, and his forthcoming book, Disunited Nations, he asserts that the United States has been providing global security for everybody, including our rivals, on the high seas, making global trade possible in a way that it never had been before, prior to the ascendancy of the United States in the aftermath of World War II. He said that the reason that the United States did this was as a bribe to all of the other countries in order to convince them to let the United States coordinate the global military and political response to the rise of the Soviet Union. Well, the Soviet Union has been gone for 30 years. and the U.S.-led global order, and he usually puts order, you know, with a capital O, the order that Zihan says is the result of, you know, the end of World War II and the fact that the U.S., instead of becoming the new boss, basically created a level playing field where lots of people could profit, lots of countries could profit. Well, the U.S. did this, you know, largely at its own expense because, again, it was a bribe. It was an inducement to get other countries to allow the United States to be the leader in coordinating global military organization in response to and directed at the containment of the Soviet Union. Zihan's position is that the order has outlived its usefulness and that the U.S. has been quietly and subtly and diplomatically withdrawing from the order for a few decades now. And that one of Donald Trump's many faux pas and sins against decorum is that he just talks about it openly. He has open disdain for NATO. He has open disdain for the NATO allies, which have basically no military of their own, particularly Germany, and who have been getting a free ride for half a century from the U.S. The U.S. is done with that. We are pulling out. Now, it's not, the United States is not one entity. And while American voters and the American segments of the working class, which devote, you know, which provide most of the warm bodies to go into the military meat grinder, which is to say the working class in the middle of the country and in the South, they are ready to stop being the global hegemon. But the military-industrial complex, the national security state, as Crystal Ball calls it, the national security blob, they profit from war. They profit from the United States being the military hegemon, and they want to not only continue the U.S. military involvement in places all over the world, even though our economic and strategic interests are really no longer dependent on, say, you know, the viability of the Saudi state. Saudi Arabia could collapse tomorrow, and the United States would be just fine. It would suck for China, because China is definitely dependent on Saudi Arabia for oil, but the United States is not. And so, according to Peter Zihan, the United States, rather than providing, you know, trade and military security to the world at its own expense, is withdrawing and will likely be extending that protection and that stability only to its strategic partners, Canada, Mexico, Japan, South Korea, and, if the Brits have the good sense to join the club, the United Kingdom. I am not looking at any printed material as I describe this to you. Obviously, this is a message that I have taken in. You know, I have assimilated it and can reproduce it on command. I know it pretty well. I'm not in love with it. I recognize it is a gross simplification, you know, much like the manipulation of the consumer price index that I discussed earlier in the podcast. It is a very, very complicated tale, and really, there are as many details to incorporate as you or I have the mental capacity to deal with. I understand that Zihan's worldview and this future, this, you know, his explanation as to what's happening now geopolitically and what's likely to come in the near future, that it is a simplified story. And as such, it will have blind spots and it will have things that it didn't anticipate, things that it can't really incorporate. And also, for people who just get a certain thrill from discussions of military tactics or, you know, geopolitical military contests, I say that a lot of the appeal of Peter Zihan's geopolitics is the same as the appeal of a Tom Clancy novel. So I say all of this to basically communicate two seemingly contradictory things. One, yeah, I really do. I find his message captivating and enthralling. And two, I understand its weaknesses. And I don't put too much stock in it. And in all of that explanation, I failed to mention that, you know, if you're listening to the Zero podcast, you probably know more about, you know, the hydrocarbon economy than most people do. And you know that, you know, folks like Richard Heinberg or Chris Martinson or Jim Kunstler a decade ago were saying that fracking wouldn't last. It wasn't economically viable. You know, the well depletion was so quick that it would be a flash in the pan. And that, you know, 10 years from now, now being 2008, there's no way fracking would still be a viable enterprise. And it's laughable to think. And I remember certain peak oil aficionados saying, it is utterly laughable to think that the United States will ever be energy independent. Well, here we are. Okay. I think that adequately, probably just adequately, lays the groundwork for reading Jasper's email. Jasper writes, and apparently I had read a message from Jasper on a video. I just went to my, you know, list of videos, and having done one every day for a year, and now even into January, I'm doing several a week. I couldn't comb through all of that and find the video that featured, you know, Jasper's earlier message. So this will just have to stand on its own. Jasper writes, Dear KMO, I hope this note finds you well, and I wish you all the best for this new year. Congratulations are in order for living up to your resolution to post a video every day. I did not see them all, but I saw many, and I mostly liked what I saw. Your Friday sessions with Colin at the studio were especially hilarious, and your book reviews were valuable and insightful, especially on the tech front. Also, thanks for getting me into Andrew Yang. While I'm at it, I never did thank you for reading my previous letter on the air. Initially, I was displeased because I found the contrast between the soundbite nature of the YouTube format and the long-form letter a bit grating, but it was a real treat to hear you bring my prose to life like that. My New Year's project this year is to disentangle myself from the big tech firms. To that end, I have switched to Linux and am looking for alternatives for Google services. A liberated smartphone would also seem to be on the horizon. Will this become a live option, a sort of digital third way in a world dominated by the G-Mafia? And I'll stop there and break down the G-Mafia. That is Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, IBM, and Apple. So backing up to the beginning of the sentence, will this become a live option, a sort of digital third way in a world dominated by the G-Mafia? Probably not. But it is fun to think about. Most of the local internet companies, search, social, and whatnot, in Europe were rapidly outcompeted by the likes of Facebook and Google. But there is plenty of talent in these countries. A fair bit of it, especially in Germany and the Netherlands, goes into open source projects of various kinds. I had meant to delve into geopolitics at length, but I quickly descended into rambling. Perhaps it is best dealt with in smaller chunks. Peter Zeihan's analysis, in which you seem to have invested quite a bit of emotional energy, seems to me to be predicated on the same sort of resource determinism as the peak oil narrative. I applaud your interest in geopolitics because I am intensely interested in that subject, and I look forward to the content you may produce, but I worry, isn't this in some ways the mirror image of the peak oil worldview? Granted, I still have my doubts about the economic viability of the giant fracking enterprise, but I admit that it produces plenty of oil. I will wait for it to be reproduced in Australia before I pass judgment. I also admit that if you add Canada and Venezuela to the U.S. column, there is no real reason to care about the Middle East, where the American supply lines are concerned. However, having resources does not necessarily translate into great economic prosperity. Japan has no great natural resources, but is the third largest economy in the world. Brazil is fabulously wealthy in terms of resources, but remains a middling economic power. Thus, if the dollar fails as the reserve currency, and if the oil boom continues, the U.S. might well fall victim to a massive case of the Dutch disease. And here I will pause. He has provided a link to the Wikipedia entry for Dutch disease. As is my habit, I will read just the portion that is above the table of contents. So this is the super high-level overview description of Dutch disease. In economics, the Dutch disease is the apparent causal relationship between the increase in the economic development of a specific sector, for example, natural resources, and a decline in other sectors, like the manufacturing sector or agriculture. The putative mechanism is that, as revenues increase in the growing sector, or inflows of foreign aid, the given nation's currency becomes stronger, appreciates, compared to the currencies of other nations, manifest in exchange rates. This results in the nation's other exports becoming more expensive for other countries to buy, and imports becoming cheaper, making those sectors less competitive. While it most often refers to natural resource discovery, it can also refer to any development that results in a large inflow of foreign currency, including a sharp surge in natural resource prices, foreign assistance, and foreign direct investment. So that's Dutch disease backing up a sentence in Jasper's email. Thus, if the dollar fails as the reserve currency, and if the oil boom continues, the U.S. might well fall victim to a massive case of the Dutch disease. Regarding the post-war order, I think the U.S. did benefit, though not as much as it arguably could have. It benefited by not letting Europe fall to communism and losing a key market, and it benefited by dominating Latin America in a neo-imperialist fashion. It also benefited greatly from the dollar's status as the reserve currency. You are quite right, though, that it has long since passed the point of diminishing, if not negative, returns, and that the world order is due for an overhaul. I don't think military personnel posted overseas is a fair proxy for international involvement, as the nature of war has been transformed since the NATO-Warsaw Pact confrontation ended. That war, that never was always conceived as World War 2.5. And it is the war that, to be crude about it, military establishments have giant hard-ons for. Giant fronts with tanks sweeping continents. The face of war in the 21st century is quite different. It is Syria, Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan. A better proxy for international involvement seems to me to be the number of countries in which the U.S. maintains a military presence of some kind. The global order is creaking, and when America does retreat from its role as the hegemon, it will surely be missed, as whatever order replaces it will be much worse. With warmest regards, Jasper. All right, there's a lot to respond to there. I'll start with the Dutch disease. If you look at, and this is, you know, a super extreme case, but it's illustrative, Venezuela. Venezuela has a shit ton of oil. It's difficult to access oil. It's mostly offshore. A lot of it is in deep water. A lot of it is, you know, below a lot of water and then below a lot of ground or a lot of salt. It'll take a lot of capital investment and a lot of expertise to access most of that oil. But, you know, if the country were politically stable and friendly to, you know, Western democracies, the capital and the expertise would be no limitation whatsoever. Hugo Chavez basically used the oil wealth of the country to spread money and goodwill around Latin America and around the Caribbean, and also to provide the citizens with generous subsidies to the point where the rest of the economy was kind of atrophied. It wasn't as complex and robust as it needed to be in order to support, you know, the population in the style in which they had become accustomed before oil prices fell through the floor. Now, this wasn't a problem for Chavez because he went and died, but it has certainly been a problem for his successor. And over the past year, largely as a result of taking in a lot of Zihan and also George Freeman, I no longer regard the United States with the reflexive cynicism that I have for most of my life, and which I know a lot of C-Realm listeners do. A lot of people who are, you know, intellectual, intelligent, left-leaning in some of their politics anyway. In a lot of the circles in which I have, you know, moved throughout my life and felt very comfortable, just the safest opinion in the world is to demonize the United States. That is, for a great many people, an easy no-hassle zone in which to slip in order to be able to carry on a conversation and not say anything that's going to get you in trouble. Is there any danger that the United States, with all of the hydrocarbon wealth of oil, and I think more importantly for the long term, natural gas, is this font of, you know, hydrocarbon resources going to cause the rest of the U.S. economy to atrophy? I don't think so. The United States has got one of the most robust tech sectors in the world. I'm no fan of big finance. You know, I'm no fan of Wall Street, but in terms of banking and finance and global investment, you know, the United States is definitely a leader in that area. And as much as the American middle class has been hollowed out with the loss of manufacturing jobs, I think with automation and also with the coming turbulence in the global order, that a lot of manufacturing is and will continue to return to the United States. It won't necessarily bring with it high-paying manufacturing jobs that, you know, we're used to from the 20th century. But I think the United States has a very robust, well-developed, diversified economy. And while we're certainly not invulnerable, compared to just about any other country, we're sitting pretty. Now, Jasper writes, I don't think military personnel posted overseas is a fair proxy for international involvement, as the nature of war has been transformed since the NATO-Warsaw Pact confrontation ended. Absolutely. The Bush administration, but even more so, on a much bigger scale, the Obama administration, has really shifted into drone warfare, which is the early, early stages of automated, you know, robotic warfare. The Pentagon is pushing hard, hard for autonomous weapon systems. They want to get the human beings out of the whole process of projecting military power globally. Why? Well, humans, one, are expensive. Two, they're fallible and inconsistent. And three, they complain, and their families complain when they get killed. I think it is more than fair to describe the United States as profoundly war-weary after 20 years of continuous foreign war since 9/11. We don't hear much about Vietnam syndrome anymore, but, you know, throughout the 1970s, all of the 1980s, and into the 1990s, you know, right up until, I think, the first Gulf War, there was a huge insecurity in the United States around the absolute fiasco that was the Vietnam War. And I think that the invasion of Afghanistan, and more importantly, the invasion of Iraq, historically speaking, is going to make the Vietnam War look like a footnote. So yeah, we don't want war. We as a population, we as, you know, a country of human beings who have family, children that we love, parents that we love, we don't want to see our loved ones killed in war, and we don't want them to have to go and kill other people in war. And we have compassion for the families of the people killed, you know, by our troops, by our bombs, by our missiles. We've had enough. We don't want any more. And the Pentagon realizes that, and they also realize that if they can just get the expensive, whiny, fallible, inconsistent humans out of the loop, they can really get something done. So yeah, the number of troops stationed abroad is not a one-to-one indicator of international involvement or military ambition on the part of the national security blob. That said, do some internet searching. Search for U.S. foreign troop deployment graph. Find a pie chart of where U.S. troops are stationed. We have a lot of troops stationed in South Korea. That makes perfect sense. The South Koreans really want us to be there. And we have our troops strategically stationed such that if North Korea makes an aggressive move on South Korea, they will just in passing also invoke the wrath of the United States because they're going to have to kill about 30,000 U.S. soldiers. We have a lot of troops stationed in Japan. But the Japanese have been, at the urging of the United States, have been remilitarizing in recent decades. And if Peter Zeihan is right, those Japanese military forces are going to be put to use in a conflict with China over control of shipping lanes and, you know, for energy resources, particularly oil, in the coming years. But also the other big representative on that map of where U.S. troops are stationed is Germany. Germany, Angela Merkel, you know, in particular, is relentlessly critical of the United States and relentlessly critical of Donald Trump. Now, I know if you're listening to this, chances are high that you hate Donald Trump, but your hatred is not, it is not rational. It is not in proportion to the man's sins. And when it comes to relations with Germany, his greatest sin is just saying, look, Germany, World War II is way back in the rearview mirror. You need to provide for your own military defense, and you're making no moves to do so. We are pulling out. You are going to need to pony up. Donald Trump is openly contemptuous of NATO, and there's good reason to be. NATO was a response to the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact military alliance. That Warsaw Pact is long gone. But NATO as an organization, as soon as its reason for existence was taken away, as all organizations do, it started casting around for a new mission, a new self-justifying story. And that story basically has two major themes right now. One is international terrorism, and the other is an expansionist Russia. And, you know, it might be in poor taste to say it, but it really needs to be said openly. Neither one of those are particularly a problem of the United States. You know, we were psychologically traumatized on 9/11, but in terms of the economic value of the damage, over the long haul, it was negligible. Certainly negligible compared to what we spent on, you know, military adventures in response to that day. In terms of lives lost, you know, it's a week's worth of traffic accidents in the United States. It's a blip. It's inconsequential compared to the number of people dying now from drug overdoses and suicide. ISIS, Iran, you know, and their proxies, Hezbollah, they present no real danger to the United States. They present a great danger to the, you know, strategic ambitions of the military-industrial complex and the national security blob. But they pose no threat to the citizenry of the United States or our infrastructure or our ability to, you know, conduct trade with our trade partners. It's not a threat. It certainly does not justify the amount of, you know, money and lives that we throw at this Middle Eastern project, which just seems more and more futile to more and more people every day. You might hate Donald Trump and just reflexively oppose everything he says. And if he says, you know, the U.S. is giving more to NATO than we get from it, because, you know, if Donald Trump says the sky is blue, you're going to be open to the idea that it's red. Yeah, I understand why so many people on the left are reflexively angry at Donald Trump for delaying the delivery of military assets to a country which borders Russia, which is to say Ukraine. That was his great sin, was holding up the shipment of arms to a state involved, you know, to one of our proxy states, basically. To the United States, Ukraine is an asset for conducting a proxy war against Russia. And if you think the greatest sin in the world, a sin so grave that a president of the United States should be removed from office for inhibiting, for slowing down for just an instant, the transfer of weapon systems into this really volatile area of the world, if you think that's a great sin, well, take Donald Trump out of the equation and think on it for a couple years, and you might come to the realization that it'll be okay if the United States stops funding and arming combatants on the other side of the world. In the mid to late 21st century, it seems very plausible and likely to me that the U.S. will no longer be everybody's daddy. And if you thought daddy was heavy-handed and kind of abusive, well, let me know how you like absent dad. As Jasper puts it, when America does retreat from its role as the global hegemon, it will surely be missed, as whatever order replaces it will be much worse. So Peter Zeihan stresses the advantages that the United States has moving into this new era of global instability. But obviously, we have our challenges. Wealth inequality, drug addiction, suicide, the uselessness of more and more, mostly men. We have our challenges. And it's going to take all of our creativity, all of our inventiveness, all of our discipline and willpower to address these issues. And we don't have the spare bandwidth to bring stability to the world. So, you know, to all the people who have complained about the abusive treatment that the U.S. has delivered into the rest of the world in the past half century, well, you know, here it comes. You're going to see what the world looks like without the stability provided by the U.S. Let me know how you like it. All right, I'm going to leave it there. As I mentioned, after the normal official close of the podcast, there will be some stuff from YouTube. Some of it might be something that I didn't produce and is copyrighted. And if so, I don't know how it got there. It's certainly not integral to this podcast. And if there happens to be some thematic overlap with what I've said here in the last few minutes, well, that's just a coincidence. Anyway, thanks for taking this ride with me. It is ongoing. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.
Newly elected Utah Senator Mitt Romney kicked off 2019 with an op-ed in the Washington Post that savaged Donald Trump's character and leadership. Romney's attack and Trump's response this morning on Twitter are the latest salvos in a long-standing personal feud between the two men. It's even possible that Romney is planning to challenge Trump for the Republican nomination in 2020. We'll see. But for now, Romney's piece is fascinating on its own terms and well worth reading. It's a window into how the people in charge in both parties see our country. Romney's main complaint in the piece is that Donald Trump is a mercurial and divisive leader. That's true, of course. But beneath the personal slights, Romney has a policy critique of Trump. He seems genuinely angry that Donald Trump might pull American troops out of the Syrian civil war. Romney doesn't explain how staying in Syria would benefit America. He doesn't appear to consider that a relevant question. More policing in the Middle East is always better. We know that. Virtually everyone in Washington agrees. Corporate tax cuts are also popular in Washington, and Romney is strongly on board with those, too. His piece throws a rare compliment to Trump for cutting the corporate rate a year ago. That's not surprising. Romney spent the bulk of his business career at a firm called Bain Capital. Bain Capital all but invented what is now a familiar business strategy. Take over an existing company for a short period of time, cut costs by firing employees, run up the debt, extract the wealth, and move on, sometimes leaving retirees without their earned pensions. Romney became fantastically rich doing this. Meanwhile, a remarkable number of the companies are now bankrupt or extinct. This is the private equity model. A ruling class sees nothing wrong with it. It's how they run the country. Mitt Romney refers to unwavering support for a finance-based economy and an internationalist foreign policy as the mainstream Republican view. And he's right about that. For generations, Republicans have considered it their duty to make the world safe for banking while simultaneously prosecuting ever more foreign wars. Modern Democrats generally support those goals enthusiastically. There are signs, however, that most people do not support this agenda, and not just here in America. In countries around the world, France, Brazil, Sweden, the Philippines, Germany, many others, voters suddenly are backing candidates and ideas that would have been unimaginable just a decade ago. These are not isolated events. What you're watching is entire populations revolting against leaders who refuse to improve their lives. Something like this has been happening in our country for the past 3 years. Donald Trump rode a surge of popular discontent all the way to the White House. Does he understand the political revolution that he harnessed? Can he reverse the economic and cultural trends that are destroying America? Those are open questions. But they're less relevant than we think. At some point, Donald Trump will be gone. The rest of us will be gone, too. The country will remain. What kind of country will it be then? How do we want our grandchildren to live? Those are the only questions that matter. The answer to them used to be obvious. The overriding goal for America is more prosperity, meaning cheaper consumer goods. But is that still true? Does anyone still believe that cheaper iPhones or more Amazon deliveries of plastic garbage from China are going to make us happy? They haven't so far. A lot of Americans are drowning in stuff. And yet drug addiction and suicide are depopulating large parts of the country. Anyone who thinks the health of a nation can be summed up in GDP is an idiot. The goal for America is both simpler and more elusive than mere prosperity. It's happiness. There are a lot of ingredients in being happy. Dignity, purpose, self-control, independence, above all, deep relationships with other people. Those are the things that you want for your children. They're what our leaders should want for us and would want if they cared. But our leaders don't care. We are ruled by mercenaries who feel no long-term obligation to the people they rule. They're day traders, substitute teachers. They're just passing through. They have no skin in this game, and it shows. They can't solve our problems. They don't even bother to understand our problems. One of the biggest lies our leaders tell us is that you can separate economics from everything else that matters. Economics is a topic for public debate. Family and faith and culture, meanwhile, those are personal matters. Both parties believe this. Members of our educated upper middle classes, now the backbone of the Democratic Party, usually describe themselves as fiscally responsible and socially moderate. In other words, functionally libertarian. They don't care how you live as long as the bills are paid and the markets function. Somehow they don't see a connection between people's personal lives and the health of our economy, or for that matter, the country's ability to pay its bills. As far as they're concerned, these are two totally separate categories. Social conservatives, meanwhile, come to the debate from the opposite perspective and yet reach a strikingly similar conclusion. The real problem, you'll hear them say, is that the American family is collapsing. Nothing can be fixed before we fix that. Yet, like the libertarians they claim to oppose, many social conservatives also consider markets sacrosanct. The idea that families are being crushed by market forces never seems to occur to them. They refuse to consider it. Questioning markets feels like apostasy. Both sides in this miss the obvious point. Culture and economics are inseparably intertwined. Certain economic systems allow families to thrive. Thriving families make market economies possible. You cannot separate the two. It used to be possible to deny this, but it's not anymore. The evidence is now overwhelming. How do we know? Consider the inner cities. 30 years ago, conservatives looked at Detroit and Newark and many other places, and they were horrified by what they saw. Conventional families had all but disappeared in poor neighborhoods. The majority of children were born out of wedlock. Single mothers were the rule. Crime and drugs and disorder became universal. What caused this nightmare? Well, liberals didn't even want to acknowledge the question. They were benefiting from the disaster in the form of reliable votes. Conservatives, though, had an explanation for inner city dysfunction, and it made sense. Big government. Decades of badly designed social programs had driven fathers from the home and created what conservatives called a culture of poverty that trapped people in generational decline. Well, there was truth in this, but it wasn't the whole story. How do we know? Well, because virtually the same thing has happened decades later to an entirely different population. In many ways, rural America now looks a lot like Detroit. This is striking because rural Americans wouldn't seem to have very much in common with anyone from the inner city. The groups have different cultures, different traditions, different political beliefs. Usually they have different skin colors. Rural people are white conservatives, mostly. Yet the pathologies of modern rural America are familiar to anyone who visited downtown Baltimore in the 1980s. Stunning out-of-wedlock birth rates, high male unemployment, a terrifying drug epidemic. Two different worlds, similar outcomes. How did this happen? Well, you'd think our ruling class would be deeply interested in knowing the answer, but mostly they're not. They don't have to be interested. It's easier to import foreign labor to take the place of native-born Americans who are slipping behind. But Republicans now represent rural voters. They ought to be interested. And here's a big part of the answer. Male wages declined. Manufacturing, a male-dominated industry, all but disappeared over the course of a generation. All that remained in many places were the schools and the hospitals, and both of them are traditional employers of women. In many areas, women suddenly made more than men. Now, before you applaud that as a victory for feminism, consider some of the effects. Study after study has shown that when men make less than women, women generally don't want to marry them. Now, maybe they should want to marry them, but they don't. Over big populations, this causes a drop in marriage, a spike in out-of-wedlock births, and all the familiar disasters that inevitably follow. More drug and alcohol abuse, higher incarceration rates, fewer families formed in the next generation. This is not speculation. It's not propaganda from the evangelicals. It's social science. We know it's true. Rich people know it best of all. That's why they get married before they have kids. That model works. But increasingly, marriage is a luxury only the affluent in America can afford. And yet, and here's the bewildering and infuriating part, those very same affluent married people, the ones who make virtually all the decisions in our society, are doing pretty much nothing to help the people below them get and stay married. Rich people are happy to fight malaria in Congo, but working to raise men's wages in Dayton or Detroit, that's crazy. This is negligence on a massive scale. Both parties ignore the crisis in marriage. Our mindless cultural leaders act like it's still 1961. And the biggest problem American families face is that sexism is preventing millions of housewives from becoming investment bankers or Facebook executives. For our ruling class, more investment banking is almost always the answer. They teach us it's more virtuous to devote your life to some soulless corporation than it is to raise your own kids. Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook wrote an entire book about this. Sandberg explained that our first duty is to shareholders above our own children. No surprise there. Sandberg herself is one of America's biggest shareholders. Propaganda like this has made her rich. What's remarkable is how the rest of us responded to it. We didn't question why Sandberg was saying this. We didn't laugh in her face at the pure absurdity of it. Our corporate media celebrated Sheryl Sandberg as the leader of a liberation movement. Her book became a bestseller, Lean In, as if putting a corporation first is empowerment. It is not. It is bondage. And Republicans should say so. They should also speak out against the ugliest parts of our financial system. Not all commerce is good. Why is it defensible to loan people money they can't possibly repay or charge them interest that impoverishes them? Payday loan outlets in poor neighborhoods collect 400% annual interest. Are we okay with that? We should not be. Libertarians tell us that's how markets work, consenting adults making voluntary decisions about how to live their lives. Okay, but it's also disgusting. If you care about America, you ought to oppose the exploitation of Americans, whether it's happening in the inner city or on Wall Street. And by the way, if you really loved your fellow Americans, as our leaders should, it would break your heart to see them high all the time, which they are. A huge number of our kids, especially our boys, are smoking weed constantly. You may not realize that because new technology has made it all but odorless, but it's everywhere. And that's not an accident. Once our leaders understood they could get rich from marijuana, marijuana became ubiquitous. In many places, tax-hungry politicians have legalized or decriminalized it. Former Speaker of the House John Boehner now lobbies for the marijuana industry. His fellow Republicans seem fine with that. Oh, but it's better for you than alcohol, they tell us. Maybe. Who cares? Talk about missing the point. Try having dinner with a 19-year-old who's been smoking weed. The life is gone. Passive, flat, trapped in their own heads. Do you want that for your kids? Of course not. Then why are our leaders pushing it on us? You know the reason. Because they don't care about us. When you care about people, you do your best to treat them fairly. Our leaders don't even try. They hand out jobs and contracts and scholarships and slots at prestigious universities based purely on how we look. There's nothing less fair than that, though our tax code does come close. Under our current system, an American who works for a salary pays about twice the tax rate as someone who's living off inherited money. It doesn't work at all. We tax capital at half the rate we tax labor. It's a sweet deal if you work in finance, as many of our richest people do. In 2010, for example, Mitt Romney made about $22 million in investment income. He paid an effective federal tax rate of 14%. For normal upper middle class wage earners, the federal tax rate is nearly 40%. No wonder Mitt Romney supports the status quo. But for everyone else, it's infuriating. Our leaders rarely mention any of this. They tell us our multi-tiered tax code is based on the principles of the free market. Please. It's based on laws that the Congress passed, laws that companies lobbied for in order to increase their economic advantage. And it worked well for those people. They did increase their economic advantage. But for everyone else, there was a big cost. Unfairness is profoundly divisive. When you favor one child over another, your kids don't hate you. They hate each other. And that happens in countries, too. It's happening in our country, probably by design. Divided countries are easier to rule. And nothing divides us like the perception that some people are getting special treatment. In our country, some people definitely are getting special treatment. Republicans should oppose that with everything they have. So the question is, what kind of country do you want to live in? Well, a fair country, a decent country, a cohesive country, a country whose leaders don't accelerate the forces of change purely for their own profit and amusement, a country you might recognize when you're old, a country that listens to young people who don't live in Brooklyn, a country where you can make a solid living outside of the big cities, a country where Lewiston, Maine seems almost as important as the west side of Los Angeles. A country where environmentalism means getting outside and picking up the trash. A clean, orderly, stable country that respects itself. And above all, a country where normal people with an average education who grew up no place special can get married and have happy kids and repeat unto the generations. A country that actually cares about families, the building block of everything. What will it take to get a country like that? Leaders who want it. For now, those leaders will have to be Republicans. There's no option at this point. But first, Republican leaders will have to acknowledge that market capitalism is not a religion. Market capitalism is a tool, like a staple gun or a toaster. You'd have to be a fool to worship it. Our system was created by human beings for the benefit of human beings. We do not exist to serve markets, just the opposite. Any economic system that weakens and destroys families is not worth having. A system like that is the enemy of a healthy society. Internalizing all this will not be easy for Republican leaders. They'll have to unlearn decades of bumper sticker talking points and corporate propaganda. They'll likely lose donors in the process. They'll be criticized. Libertarians are certain to call any deviation from market fundamentalism a form of socialism. That's a lie. Socialism is a disaster. It does not work. In fact, it's what we should be working desperately to avoid. But socialism is exactly what we're going to get, and very soon, unless a group of responsible people in our political system reforms the American economy in a way that protects normal people. If you want to put America first, you've got to put its families first.
Well, hey, I'm here with Irv Mills. And Irv, you do something which is very impressive to me. You keep a record of everything you read. And you...
You post it to the Sea Realm group on MeWe.
I do that, yes. Actually, I post it on my blog, The Easiest Person to Fool. You know, in truth, there's some things I read which I don't bother putting on the list.
Out of shame or what?
Well, some of them, probably, yeah. And some out of, why did I read that? What a waste of my time. So, anyways, that's neither here nor there. I guess you had a look at that list and the last one I posted a few days ago, and there were a few things that you thought might be interesting to talk about.
Well, I've just wrapped up a week's dog sitting, and I don't have a dog of my own. I haven't in many years, but I very much love dogs. But different breeds are different stories. So I was dog sitting for a rat terrier, and I would never, never own a rat terrier. They're just too high energy and too high maintenance.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I too love dogs, and I've had dogs since I was a little kid. And I have one now. He's a part husky, and he's 15 years old. So when he was much younger, I guess he was about a year when we got him. He was, high energy too, but he slowed down quite a bit.
Now, 15's long in the tooth for a big dog.
It sure is. It sure is. The vet is amazed every time we take him for a checkup that he's still around. Yeah.
But when I came back home from my week with the high maintenance, high energy dog, and collapsed into my easy chair, soon I had a very comfortable, very easygoing three-legged cat curling up, you know, on my stomach. And the relationship with the cat is just so normal and natural and easy for me. And I get irritated when people describe the relationship of humans and their domestic pets as a relationship of slavery or domination. And particularly when, you know, they use the word slavery. And I mostly hear this from vegans. And I noticed that there was a lot of vegan talking points in the Guardian article that you had posted, you know, in that list of things that you had read. What was it about that article that really captivated you or piqued your interest?
Well, I guess the title, which got that here, I hope. Have it printed out.
Oh, paper. I see. Goodness.
Oh, yes. I'm an old guy. Yeah. Should we stop keeping pets? That's what caught my eye. And to be honest, I can see that from one angle, and that is the cost of keeping pets it seems to me higher these days than it used to be. Of course, when I was growing up on the farm, if a dog got sick, his life ended quickly.
My parents' dog, the family dog when I was born, and you know, she was in the family before I was, her mother and all of her siblings except one had been shot by my uncle. Just that was, you know, in Arkansas on the farm. That was how you controlled the number of dogs. You know, there was no notion of spaying or neutering. Your dog got pregnant again too soon and there were too many puppies around and no homes for them, you shot them. And that was the humane thing to do, because the alternative was just to let them go out and be feral and live really short, miserable lives.
Exactly. Well, we always had the female dogs fixed, neutered. Can't remember having a male dogs, but I presume we would have done the same thing with them. But we had a dog that we got when I was about 8 years old, and I was around 15 years old when it got to the point where it couldn't get up anymore. And Dad came to me one day and said, "I think you better take that dog out behind the barn and put it down, because it's obviously in a lot of pain and it can't even get up on its own anymore." So I'd been really close to that dog, but I went and got the 22 rifle we use for trying to keep the groundhog population down, and took the dog out behind the barn and put it down. And I don't know, that this didn't like permanently scar me or anything, but it left me with a pretty clear idea that you have a responsibility to a pet when it gets to that age. And if there's nothing to be done, then you have to end its life. I see a lot of people having trouble with that these days, and I'm critical of some vets who seem to want to play into it and see the dog as a profit center.
Right, and shame you into spending thousands of dollars to extend its life a very short period and with no quality of life.
Exactly. That bothers me.
We're not really touching on the arguments from the Guardian article, which, you know, was...
No, I was thinking we should get to that. their arguments were entirely different. And yes, as you say, largely based on the thinking that I encounter from vegans, which is that dogs are people, pets are people. And I strongly disagree with that. They're not people. Animals in general aren't people. Although I'll grant you, maybe for at least some of the primates, and maybe dolphins and whales, maybe even elephants, I've been reading recently, that they are intelligent enough that perhaps, yes, we should not treat them as property. But the thing that I think that I kept seeing in that article was comments to the effect that the such and such a pet obviously has emotions. And maybe what seem like human emotions, and therefore then there's this huge leap, which I don't follow, therefore it must be human. All mammals have emotions and some degree of intelligence, but that doesn't mean that they are or should be treated as people. Of course, I'll grant you, and you've done a video on YouTube about, do dogs, what was it? Are dogs too good for people?
Yeah. There's a very popular family of YouTube memes, which tells the story of a dog which did something which seems selfless or, fairly angelic. And then, the takeaway message is dogs are too good for humans. And this overlaps heavily with the humans suck, we hate humans, humans should all die out, mentality,
yeah,
which is
yeah,
very popular, particularly
it
online,
is.
Which I find to be absolutely just childish and puerile. And I have absolutely no respect at all for that point of view. And I noticed that, the mentality in this Guardian article was skirting the edge there. Basically
it really
saying,
was.
Dogs and cats have complex emotional states, therefore they are deserving of respect. And then here's the big leap. Therefore, we should have nothing to do with them ever.
There
is no ethical interaction between human beings and non-human animals is the vegan position, which I think is absurd, particularly with dogs, because we are co-evolved with dogs. They're a cooperative hunting species. We were a cooperative hunting species. We shared an environment. We discovered that we did better together than we did separately, and we've been together ever since. We don't have to hunt anymore, but we still enjoy each other's presence and company, and we are very well adapted to one another. So the idea that simply because dogs have complex emotional states that we should have nothing to do with them, and that the whole species, Canis familiaris, should not exist, because, without humans, dogs don't exist. They're very different animals if they're not raised, collaboratively with human beings. They're a very
yes,
different animal. So to say that, the pet dog that we're all familiar with shouldn't exist because they have complex emotional states, to me, there is no linkage between those two statements. There is no causal chain that leads you from one to the other.
It simply doesn't follow. And good for you in what you say there, Camo. The thing is, I would respond back to the people who say that we're not, or that they're too good for us, that yeah, there are some people who treat dogs in a way that I would say they're not good enough for the dogs. But this isn't universal.
Right. And those people often ruin the dogs. Those are often really lousy dogs that get mistreated like that.
You know,
because of mistreatment.
Yeah, they're lousy after the mistreatment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and shortly after I retired in 2005, we got involved in a pet rescue organization. They were in need of people to foster dogs that came in. And this was a pet rescue organization that did not ever put animals down. Mm-hmm. They either fostered them forever if no one could be found to adopt them, or they adopted them out. And that's how we got the dog we have now. And we fostered one before we got him, and one or two after as well. And I mean, okay, some of the pet rescue people are a little extreme in their
to put it mildly.
In their ideas about how dogs should be treated and who should have them.
But, or what constitutes being rescued. We can get into that later.
Okay. Well, I didn't encounter much of that. I don't think any of these dogs had been stolen, sort of, but
you're clearly not familiar with the absurdity that I'm talking about, so we'll get to that in a minute. Go ahead, complete.
Okay. No, but I think they did a good thing, and yeah, okay, you can take any good thing to an extreme, but eventually most of the dogs that we fostered got adopted, and the one that didn't, well, he didn't leave us because we adopted him. Anyways, I kind of lost where I was going with that. Maybe that's as far as I was going. But I'm interested to hear what sort of things you've heard about rescue organizations.
Well, in southern Missouri, and you know, I have family in northern Arkansas, so southern Missouri is just a stone's throw away.
Yeah.
There are a couple of different nationally known purebred dog auctions that take place throughout the year. So breeders from around the country bring their animals here, you know, to auction them off. Well, pet rescue people who are very successful at, you know, raising money online, they come to these auctions with full pockets, and they end up getting into these bidding wars with breeders who have come to, you know, to buy dogs to breed them. And so they run up the price on these dogs. So they could be paying $10,000 or more for a single animal. You know, the money is coming from people who had their heartstrings tugged on, you know, and said, oh yes, I want to rescue animals from bad conditions. I don't think any of those people were thinking, oh, I want you to take my money and go to an auction and, you know, have a bidding battle with breeders to, you know, basically support demand for more dogs. I mean, the more these dogs sell for at auction, the more financial motivation breeders have to overbreed and create more of them. So that seems like the ultimate absurdity to me. Now, on the other hand, I'm from the South, and I know that in the South, people take a very different attitude to animal welfare, and it is very common to just take a dog that you don't want out into the countryside, kick it out of the car, and drive away. And shelters in the Northeast, where I am, are full of dogs who have been taken from shelters in the South and transported north by the whole dog rescue network. So
yes,
they're doing good work on that level. But
yes,
they take it to absurd extremes, which arguably make the problem they're trying to address worse.
Yeah, that I think the rescue organization I was involved with was actually getting dogs from the States, come and taking them across the border, which I can't imagine the amount of paperwork there might be involved in, but they were, yeah, the kind of thing you're talking about. And I live in a little town out in the country here in southern Ontario, and yes, people do come to this area from the city and drop dogs off, which appalls me, but a lot of the dogs that end up being rescued around here, that's where they're coming from, is they've been caught by the local dog catcher, or some individuals caught them and taken them to the local vet. And the lady who runs this rescue organization has contacts with all these people. And rather than put a dog down, if it hasn't been claimed in a few days, they call her, and she finds a place to foster it and eventually to adopt it out. And, you know, I think that's a great way to get a dog. You have to understand that as a result of this experience, the dog may have some personality traits that are less than optimal, but yeah, they usually come around. And an interesting thing, there's a non-trivial fee involved in adopting one of these rescue dogs. Yes, and part of that fee is you get a it pays for a training course that you and the dog go to at some point. And we went to that, and I was very impressed with the lady who was giving it. It was her style of training animals was superior, in my opinion. I've seen sort of three different ways that people train dogs. One is with cruelty, you might say. You know,
punishment.
Punishment, exactly. When they do something wrong, they get punished. And that may, to some extent, work, but it ends up with a pretty strange dog when you're done, I think. And the other approach, which actually my daughter has a dog that she rescued, a little beagle, and they took it for training, and the guy was big into this whole dominance hierarchy thing, which you might think would work, but from what I've seen, not really the way to go if that's all you're relying on. And the way the lady we trained with, it was positive reinforcement. And the dog does something good, you reward it. And
did she use a clicker?
Yeah, she did.
That's ideal. For people who don't know what I'm talking about, a clicker is just a little piece of metal that you hold in your hand, and you can squeeze it, and it makes a little clicking sound. And the dog knows from experience that when it hears a click, it's entitled to a treat. But it allows the trainer to really finely tune the timing of the reinforcement. So when the dog is doing something you want, you click. The dog associates the click with the food, even though you're not delivering the food in that instant. The dog is still taking it as positive reinforcement, and you can be really selective and precise in shaping a dog's behavior that way. It takes amazing patience and experience to get good at that, though. I've tried. It's not easy.
Yeah, well, I think we took our dog at a time when he was prime for training, and he caught on real quick. And
how old was he?
Right around year and a half, yep. Maybe not quite that old. And he caught on real quick and went from being a real nuisance to being a pretty good dog.
This was your husky?
Yeah, yeah. He still got away a lot. Huskies are like that. They like to go
Huskies
for a run.
They're very athletic dogs. They're
yeah,
a high you know, input dog, particularly when they're young.
Yeah, he could jump he had to run in our backyard, but unfortunately he could jump a 6-foot fence and go for a run. He had a tag on his collar with our number on it, and people in this, there's a lot of dog people in this town, and or people who are friendly to dogs, and we used to get called regularly by people who had caught him. He came, you know, nosing around their place, and they would catch him, and we'd get a call. I think we have your dog here, and we'd come and get him and bring him home. But as I say, he hasn't done that in a while because he's too old for that sort of energetic entertainment. Anyways, the other thing that I might have to offer to this conversation, branching out a little from pets into farm animals, other domesticated animals, because there I see and hear from vegans a lot of ideas that, having grown up on a farm, we raise beef and pigs, that are just plain wrong about the treatment of farm animals. And the crux of what I'm talking about here is that those animals are an asset for the farmer, and they have to be healthy and grow if he's going to make a profit on the thing. Mm-hmm. Animals that are being abused don't do well and lead to less profit. So farmers, just on that, you know, that hard-headed approach to things, don't abuse their animals at all. I remember it as a kind of a, you know, teenage type guy being sent out to round up a herd of cattle, and I took my stick with me, and if Dad caught me whacking these animals too enthusiastically, which meant basically at all, I was in trouble. You know, don't be hurting those animals. That's your meal ticket. And that just is totally counter to what the average vegan figures about the way cattle are treated on a farm. And it's become even more so these days. There's been a lot of advances in the last few decades about how barns are built and the conditions in which animals are kept, all along the idea of if they're in better conditions, they do better, and the farmer makes more money on them. So it's even worse investing in modern barns as opposed to some of the rather crude ones we had 50 years ago in order to have a more profitable farm. So that's, I haven't had much luck in convincing vegans that that's the case. They too have been watching YouTube and seen some videos taken under the worst of conditions that they assume to be essentially universal in farming.
Well, full disclosure, my mother is a cattle farmer. You know, mm-hmm. To this day, like, she wrote to me the day before yesterday to tell me about the birth of a new calf. I get those emails all the time. Yeah. Here's where the vegans are right. In the U.S., at least, most cows start off their life in a pasture, you know, nursing from their mother. The mother is grazing freely. It's a pretty bucolic and pretty nice setup, you know. But then the cows that are going to, you know, who are not just going to stay on the farm and continue to have calves every year, they get taken to auction and sold, where they get, you know, congregated. They get compacted into these CAFOs, a confined animal feeding operation. And the CAFO, where, you know, the young cows who spent the first part of their life in pretty nice conditions are now jammed together in very, you know, industrial situations. It's pretty miserable. And from that point on, their job is just to eat corn and get fat and, you know, basically get slaughtered before the corn diet, which is not suited to them, kills them. And, you know, there's a few cows that end up, you know, as grass finished. They're never force-fed corn at the end of their lives. And they live a pretty good life from beginning to end. As Michael Pollan says, you know, they have one bad day, which is their last day. But for most animals who go through the industrial pipeline, it is a pretty miserable mainstream, you know, main sequence for their life. And there's very little you can say to defend the practices of industrial scale, you know, animal agriculture.
Okay. Have you actually been to a feedlot?
I'm from Arkansas. Mm-hmm. I've been, you know, I've seen the cows on the farm. I've been to the auctions. Yes, I've seen the local feedlots. But I'm talking about the great big feedlots.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty miserable. And there's just no getting around the fact that cows are not evolved to eat corn. They won't survive on it as their staple food for very long.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I won't get into arguing about that. I don't entirely agree. But the beef in my freezer comes from a local farmer who grass finishes his cattle.
So. Right. So you have the one bad day cows.
Yeah, indeed.
They are the lottery winners, you know, in our civilization in terms of cows.
That's for sure. Yep. Anyway, so I guess that's probably about all. Is that all we have to say on pets and animals, you think?
I would just want to reiterate that I want to go back to the cat curling up in my lap. Mm-hmm. You know, the cat doesn't get to go outside. So the cat also is from Arkansas, and she started her life being able to roam outside as she pleased in the countryside, and then to come into the house as she chose to. And now she's strictly an indoor cat. So at the level of, you know, she can't choose to pick up sticks and go elsewhere, she has no choice. But there have been many times over the course of her life when she did have a choice, and she always came back. And cats, unlike dogs, frequently will just leave when they find a better situation. You know, if they find a different house that lets them in and they like the food better and they like the company better, they will ditch you. So
yes.
Cats in particular, they really are, you know, willing participants in the partnership. And the relationship, you know, particularly with my current cat, because she is three-legged and she is pretty sedentary and she is, you know, one of the few joys in her life besides eating is being petted and, you know, physical closeness. But it's just such an agreeable, convivial arrangement for the both of us. And I can see, like, I've lived in New York City where people kept dogs they had no business keeping. You know, they lived in apartments and they kept Great Danes. And I can see the absurdity of that and, you know, the inappropriateness of that and how the dog is really serving a sort of vanity purpose there. But again, without a human partnership, the dog isn't a dog. It's something else. And the something else that it is to me is, you know, it's not as interesting. It's not as fully realized as the dog who is in a good partnership with a human family or, you know, a human individual. And so I just want to stress the coevolutionary history that we have with this species. And the idea that we have no business interacting with this species, it just flies in the face of the actual evolutionary relationship, which has formed over tens of thousands of years. And also, one other thing I have on dogs. When I was a kid, you know, if the dog needed to go to the bathroom, it went to the door and it whimpered a little bit. You open the door, the dog went out under its own, you know, recognizance. And dogs who were ill-behaved eventually, they got reported, they got picked up by animal control, and they would be put down. So most dogs, you know, they were pretty well socialized and they got along all right out in the world, and they didn't have to be monitored every single second. Whereas today, it's illegal to just open the door and let your dog go out and, you know, take care of its needs. So one of the effects of this is that dogs in the past, when they could go out and do as they wanted to do, you got a lot of mutts. You got a lot of dogs breeding in an uncontrolled way, which is good for the genetic health of the species. Now, because they're so controlled and they're so locked down, and we get these crazes and fashions with particular purebred dogs and designer breeds and whatnot, there's an economic incentive for people to set up these puppy mills where, you know, the breeding dogs live in miserable conditions. They, you know, have litter after litter after litter, and the puppies are taken away too early, and all these genetic defects get bred into the dogs, and it's causing a lot of unnecessary misery. But at the same time, having locked dogs down and not letting them wander unaccompanied in the world anymore, we have a lot fewer unwanted dogs. So there are fewer dogs being put down in shelters today than there were back in the 1970s, and not, you know, a slightly lower number, like many orders of magnitude fewer dogs get euthanized now than they did in the 70s. So there's an upside and a downside, but the downside is avoidable if we understand what brings it about. And so far, there doesn't seem to be enough understanding or, you know, or care really to correct the problem of overbred dogs.
Yeah, yeah. Every time Disney puts out a movie featuring a certain breed of dog, and of course the movie star dogs sure look cute as can be, and it's a great sales pitch for the breeders of that type of dog. But yeah, exactly.
And if it's a Cocker Spaniel, fine, because those dogs are just bred to be companion dogs, and they're very friendly and they're very easy to get along with. So, you know, if people see Lady and the Tramp and they want a Cocker Spaniel, fine. But, you know, Dalmatians, Dalmatians wow. are crazy. Those are crazy, crazy dogs. They are not appropriate dogs to keep as household pets.
We had one on the farm when I was about 5 years old. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the farm was the right environment for him.
Right. So, you know, if somebody goes to see 101 Dalmatians and the kids want a Dalmatian and the parents give in because they did no research into the, you know, the breed, well, that's a dog that's probably going to end up in a shelter.
Yeah, exactly. And the same, there was a movie with huskies in it a few years ago. And I know people who went out and got purebred huskies and they were taken aback by what, once they got to know what they'd taken on, because there's a dog that needs to work.
Yeah. Blue heelers, Australian shepherds, you know, any kind of herding dog.
Yeah.
Border collies. These are not household pets. These are dogs meant to get out and work.
I'm a retired person. I don't have to work every day. I have time to put into the dog. And I do a lot of walking, or I did until I hurt my knee recently. But, you know, I used to walk 10, 15,000 steps with this dog every day. And that's, the vet says that's why he's doing so well at 15. And it certainly suited him. He just, you know, loved it. In fact, it was like having a personal trainer. If I'd go lie down for a rest after supper, he was right there saying, no, it's time for our walk. And to his benefit and mine. So, yeah, but you're right. There's sort of things going on in our economy that aren't for the best interest of dogs. But if people understand how it all works, there's no reason the pet and people relationship can't be a very positive one. And as far as the one thing I was going to say that goes along with what you're saying is really way back, many tens of thousands of years ago when we were domesticating these animals, it worked because for them it was a soft touch, you know, compared to what they would have on their own out in the wild. They liked it. We like it. You know.
And in some cases, particularly with cats, it's more that, you know, they domesticated us rather than
exactly. Exactly.
You know, they found that they did better in proximity to humans than they did away from humans. Some of them did.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Well, I think dogs did too. You know, they used to just hang around and eat from the garbage heap initially. And then we kind of found uses for them and started feeding them more. And why would you go out and fend for yourself? Like animals in the wild don't have that great a life in a lot of cases. It's pretty tough. And, you know, there's parasites they get and they get hurt and there's no one to help them. And there you are.
Yeah.
So
have you seen video of baboons that kidnap puppies and just keep them nearby so that the dogs imprint on the baboons?
I haven't, but that sure goes with what we're just saying, you know. apes domesticating animals, not even humans. Okay, that's neat.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the dog's evolutionary history with humans that makes it possible for, you know, baboons to take them in the
yes.
same way.
Yes, modern domesticated dogs are primed for that, and are willing to accept a baboon instead of a person if that's the way it goes. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the baboons are none too gentle with the puppies. It's kind of hard to watch.
Yeah, I would think. Yeah, they're kind of a rough animal. Mm-hmm. So, okay, another of the articles that you suggested we might talk about, there was one. The title is Against Metrics. Measuring.